This episode may contain content of a graphic nature, including descriptions of physical and sexual violence against adults, children, and animals. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone. I'm Talia.
And I'm Tanya.
And together we are Crimes and Consequences, a true crime podcast. Tanya.
Hi, Talia.
Welcome back, everybody, to Crimes and Consequences. Today I have a story that's much different than most of the stories we've ever done. And I want to thank our Patreon, Clevenel. I'm not sure how to pronounce her name. I want to thank her for recommending this episode for us. This is a very unusual story. It's very gruesome. There's some animal cruelty, but I will warn you in advance regarding the animal cruelty. Before I start, I'd like to ask everybody to take 1 second to hit the subscribe/follow button on the app you're listening to us on. And with that, I'm ready to start. Are you ready to listen, Tanya?
I am ready.
There's going to be some names I cannot pronounce.
As usual.
But I'm going to do my best. I've really spent some time trying to figure it out. That being said, let's do it. Sunday morning on April 3rd in 2011, Ephraim Morlong was working in his office. He was doing some paperwork, and he worked at a graveyard.
Ooh.
He was a supervisor there in the mining city of Welkom in the Free State Province in South Africa.
I think this is our first South African story.
The Welkom Cemetery is large. It has over 10,000 graves to maintain, and that had become almost too big to manage for Ephraim and a short staff team. And parts of it were overgrown and unmanicured. I mean, it's large. That Sunday morning, as Ephraim was working on his quarterly report, neck bent down over his desk, his cell phone rang. It was his foreman, Daniel Ranthimo. And in an alarming tone, he blurted out, "Ephraim, you have to come see this." Daniel had been mowing the lawn near the yellow boom gate when he made a really disturbing find. Do you know what a boom gate is?
Nope.
I didn't either. It's also called a boom barrier. It's that gate, that yellow bar that prevents a car from entering an area.
Oh, okay.
Without permission. A boom barrier.
A boom barrier. I had no idea it was called that.
I didn't either. Ephraim met up with Daniel, who by then had been joined by other graveyard employees. Daniel pointed to blood smears on the boom barrier. And then he pointed to a sandy area on the ground that was saturated with large pools of what looked like oxidized blood. Ephraim immediately understood that some sort of large animal had bled out in that spot, but there was no carcass around. Then Daniel pointed to bloody smears and spatter, in addition to footprints that trailed down a path leading to the Jewish chapel. The Jewish chapel was a small brick building with a brown slanted roof that sat in the back of the Jewish burial ground, the area in the cemetery where Jewish people are buried. Patches of blood covered the stone pavers and grass. There appeared to be a blood-soaked, crumbled-up rag laying on the ground. Daniel went to pick it up, but Ephraim stopped him. His instincts told him that had to be some sort of evidence to a crime, and it shouldn't be touched. Only once in Ephraim's graveyard career had he ever seen a body at the cemetery that wasn't brought there by one of his workers. One time he encountered a man, it was a father and a husband, so depressed over his life that he shot himself in the head between the entrance and the parking lot. But that was the only time in his whole career that he'd experienced any sort of actual blood, or for lack of a term, fresh death? I don't know, is that too morbid?
No.
Okay. The graveyard workers stood and stared at each other. Then they looked at Ephraim as if it was up to him to make the next move. I mean, he's their supervisor.
That's why he gets paid the big bucks, I'm sure.
Yeah, but he's probably thinking this is not in my...
my pay grade.
My duties. Before Ephraim could call the police, a car sped through the cemetery's stone-walled entrance and made an abrupt stop in the parking lot. three people came running out towards Efren and his crew. Only an hour before the graveyard discovery, a call was radioed into the Velcom police. Earlier, a security guard spotted a silver Peugeot that had been left unlocked and abandoned, keys in its ignition, at a taxi rink next to the Boxer Superstore. Do you know what a taxi rink is?
Nope, but I know you're going to tell me.
It's a taxi stand. A quick search of the license plate indicated that it belonged to Nais Van Eck from the Velcom suburb of Bedalia.
You do it, girl.
I don't know. Whatever. Probably not. Officers left the car with a security guard, and they drove to the owner's home. Nais Van Eck and his wife, Henriette, were fast asleep when the bell on the gate at the entrance of their driveway awoke them. Still in his pajamas, Nais went outside to speak with the officers. Henriette, seeing the police through the window, grabbed her bathrobe and slippers and went out to join them. Nais explained that although he owned the car, he had purchased it 5 months earlier for his 23-year-old son, Michael, because Michael's previous car had been totaled in a car accident. Michael had just started an internship as an electrician at the Beatrix Gold Mines Shaft 4, and his parents assumed that he drove his car to work that morning, but he didn't. When Henriette called Michael, he didn't answer. She then walked over to Michael's semi-detached apartment that was on their property to see if he was there, but he wasn't. In fact, it appeared that he'd never returned home from his first date with a girl he met online. Henriette is freaking out, as you can imagine. She called Michael's supervisor. His name was Barno Kruger. Barno told her Michael didn't show up to work that morning. Nais and Henriette drove together behind the police and made their way to the taxi rink across from the Boxer Superstore to take a look at Michael's car. It was in a bad area of town. I don't know anything about Velcom, okay? But it was described as a bad area of town, a place where if you wanted your car stolen, just leave the keys in the ignition. As they pulled up by Michael's car, they noticed a black man with a wooden leg sitting behind the wheel of the car, caught in the act of stealing it.
Oh, no.
I can't make this shit up.
Well, the keys were in it, man.
Nais yelled out, "Where's my son?" But the man was so shit-faced drunk, he couldn't even respond. As police approached the vehicle, they could see traces on the driver and passenger door handles of blood. They immediately arrested the drunken, one-legged man and took him to the station for questioning. He gave them a story about a man named Thabo who had ordered him to steal the car. And police knew Thabo. They called him up, and he was more than willing to come into the station and talk. He was really bewildered by their line of questioning. They're asking him about somebody named Michael. Where's Michael, and why are you trying to steal Michael's car? He said, "I have no idea what you guys are talking about." As the police questioned the two men, Nais, Henriette, and Michael's three sisters were calling everyone who might know where Michael was at. Michael's older sister, her name was Natasha, she was at her parents' house when, out of the blue, Michael's supervisor, Barno, showed up unannounced at the gates of their driveway. He said he urgently needed to speak with Henriette and Nais because he might have an idea where Michael was at. Natasha called her mom, and Henriette rushed home while Nais stayed back at the police station. On Henriette's drive home, she spoke to Barno on the phone. And during that conversation, he explained that the day before, that was a Saturday, while Michael was at work, he mentioned to Barno that he might meet a girl for a date. He said he'd been talking to her for about 2 days on a dating app called Tugo. It's a number two and then go. I've never heard of it. Probably because I'm married.
I was going to say, I don't think you're dating much.
No,
but
I'm not
going to call you out like that.
Thank you. After speaking to the girl for 2 days, that Saturday, they decided to actually meet in person. But Henriette already knew this. Shortly before 9 p.m. that Saturday night, the night before, Michael had came home from work. He showered. He put on a pair of jeans and this gray-blue t-shirt. And then he headed out. He told his mom that he was going to go to St. Helena's to pick up a girl at her home and take her to the movies. But that was a lie. Michael knew his mom would never approve of the truth, which he shared with Barno. The young woman whom Michael had been texting for 2 days adamantly requested that they meet at the Velcom Cemetery. She wanted to have a 9 o'clock romantic picnic there.
Red flag.
Michael knew that that was a very odd request, and he told Barno he probably wouldn't end up going. But clearly, he'd been persuaded to change his mind. Henriette, Barno, and Natasha didn't wait for the police. They didn't even call the police. They headed directly on their own to the cemetery. Once inside the gates, they spotted Ephraim, Daniel, and the other crewmen all gathering around the Jewish chapel. Henriette jumped out of her car and ran to them, calling out Michael's name. Where's Michael? Where is Michael? She immediately noticed what the men were standing and staring at. It was the t-shirt Michael had left in the night before, only it was saturated with blood. Henriette fell to her knees, clutching the bloody cloth, crying out her son's name. There were cuts all over the shirt. Everyone at the graveyard began searching the grounds for Michael, expecting to find him at least injured, but hoping to find him alive. Ephraim and his crew started with the freshly dug open graves that were meant for that week's burials. While they were searching, Henriette managed the strength to summon Nace, who quickly arrived with the police, Fabo, and the one-legged man to the cemetery. After being apprised of the situation, an officer grabbed the wooden-legged man by the back of the neck and he marched him towards the bloody t-shirt, demanding to know where Michael was. The one-legged man pleaded with them, saying, "I have nothing to do with this." He admitted he intended to steal Michael's car because he was just shit-faced drunk and needed a way home. He didn't want to walk. And he went to the taxi stand hoping to get a taxi, and at the time there were none there. He also admitted that Fabo had nothing to do with any of it. He just, in his drunken stupor, shouted out the guy's name. His passionate pleadings rang of truth, and the police no longer suspected that either man was involved in whatever happened to Michael. Police called in for backup and requested a search and rescue dog to help scour the area. Warrant Officer Duplessis from the canine unit arrived around noon with her dog Xander, a Canadian white shepherd. Xander sniffed Michael's bloody t-shirt that was taken to the outskirts of the graveyard. Xander led the officers towards the graveyard and became animated as he walked along a path towards the Jewish burial site near some pine trees. Xander gained more momentum to the point he was allowed to run free. He ran towards some shrubbery and began digging at a heap of grass and dirt. Minutes later, Xander let out a howl, signaling he'd found a body.
Oh no.
Under layers of soil, twigs, and grass, they could see a button attached to blue jeans. Scraping off more layers revealed blood-soaked blue jeans. But they weren't on anyone's legs. Instead, they were placed on top of a torso, which was missing its right arm and head and a foot. Both legs had been severed below the knee, and the left foot was missing from the shallow grave. The body was completely unearthed within a few minutes, but Michael's parents were kept at bay for obvious reasons, right? I mean, it's a very disturbing sight. Eventually, Nace, he demanded to see if the body laying in the dirt was his son.
Ugh.
He argued there's no reason why he shouldn't be able to identify him. Eventually, his persistence paid off, and he was allowed to view.
Really?
Michael's decapitated body.
Oh, no.
He immediately recognized a birthmark on his back and was able to positively ID the headless body as 23-year-old Michael, his beloved son, who'd never been anything less than a loving and kind young man. Xander and Detective Duplessis searched the entire remaining area of the graveyard, like all the graveyard, looking for Michael's missing body parts. After an hour or two, Officer Duplessis, he was insistent that Michael's head, arm, and foot were not on the property. He said if Xander didn't find it, it's not there, which meant Michael's killer or killers had to have taken his body parts with him, maybe as a trophy.
What the hell?
There were whispers amongst the police of Satanism, the occult, and muti murders. Do you know what a muti murder is?
No. I was just going to ask.
Well, let me tell you. It's a killing of a person to harvest the body parts for use in African traditional medicine, or muti.
Oh.
Another way to define it is the murder of someone in order to excise body parts for the incorporation into medicine used in witchcraft.
Okay. When you say incorporate into medicine, like the body parts are medicine?
Kind of, yeah.
Like, okay.
Yeah. Yes. Yeesh. Used in witchcraft, not by legitimate licensed physicians.
No. Yeesh. Okay.
Police estimate there is an occurrence of muti murders roughly once a month in South Africa.
Really?
So it's not that unusual.
No.
And in Valcom, muti murder wasn't such a far-fetched theory. In fact, one of the detectives that was investigating Michael's murder had recently investigated a gruesome muti murder only about an hour and a half away, in which a man was killed and his head, heart, and genitals were removed. Michael's autopsy was performed by a man named Dr. Willem van Heusden. He was not only the medical examiner, but a family friend of the Van Ecks who had sat across the table from Michael at a dinner at his house only a few weeks earlier.
Oh.
Ironically, he was the doctor that delivered Michael when he was born. And now he's in charge of performing the autopsy on his headless corpse.
It's just really sad.
That's a small world. Michael had 32 stab wounds that were found on the body that remained. His head, arms, and legs had been crudely cut from him, with some bones protruding from the areas where the missing limbs once were.
Did they remove his limbs while he was still alive?
No.
Okay.
Though things like that have happened in some of our episodes, yes. Unfortunately. Whoever disarticulated Michael didn't do it with precision. It seemed more hasty and sloppy. Michael's exact cause of death couldn't be determined, but was ruled to be a result of homicidal violence. What reason would anyone have to kill Michael? Was Michael's murder part of some ritual killing? Could he have been catfished by someone he met on a dating app? Michael was just an all-around great guy. He was adored by his parents, his friends, and his three older sisters. He'd never been arrested. He didn't do drugs. He had no known enemies. He only recently began dating after breaking up with his girlfriend, Gisella, about 6 months earlier. But that breakup was amicable. Being that he didn't drink and he didn't smoke, the club bar scene, that wasn't really a place he liked to go. And there weren't a lot of women working at the mines where he worked, which is why he chose to use the To-Go dating app.
Nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely nothing wrong with that. Swipe, what is it? Swipe one if you like them.
Right or left, I don't know.
I don't know.
That's what the kids say.
A detective assigned to the case, her name was Warrant Officer Nels, obtained Michael's phone records later on the same day he was found murdered. She dialed the last number he called, but it went straight to voicemail, and there wasn't any particular person's voice. It was like a generic voicemail. Her instinct told her the answer to Michael's murder mystery lay with the last person he spoke with. So the next day, Detective Nels and another homicide detective named Stein tried the number again. This time, the soft voice of a young woman answered. Quick-thinking Detective Stein came up with a ruse that she'd used before to get the young woman to come into the station. On the fly, without any plan in advance, Detective Stein said, quote, "Hi, I'm so sorry to disturb you. My name is Dr. Mitchell from the Valcom Hospital. We have a girl here who has just been in a very bad car accident. We're going to have to operate on her immediately, but before we can go ahead, we need someone to identify her. Your number was one of the numbers found on her cell phone brought in with her. Can you help us? Can you come to the police station right away to see a photo of her?" There was a silent pause. Then the girl on the other end of the line replied, quote, "I'm at a game store, but we can come over shortly." Detective Stein replied, quote, "Great, I didn't get your name." "Shanae," the girl replied, and then she hung up the phone. Officers wondered who the "we" was that would be visiting them soon. And 20 minutes later, they had their answer. But before I tell you more, let's take a second to listen to our sponsors, whom we're extremely grateful for. 20 minutes later, a petite young woman wearing an oversized red hoodie and black sweatpants walked into the police station with an average-looking man, maybe in his early 20s. This young woman had long, jet black hair with black painted fingernails to match. Her small stature and youthful appearance gave the illusion she was harmless. Such a tiny young girl couldn't possibly be the perpetrator of a gruesome and morbid crime. But looks can be deceiving. Soon, 20-year-old Shanae Van Heerden would be recognized as one of South Africa's most evil and dangerous women of all time.
Damn, that's quite the moniker.
Yeah, she's a freak. I'm just going to tell it. Spoiler alert. I have to give you the background of Shanae because she is so odd and so evil. Shanae was born in 1990 to Charmaine and Jacques Van Heerden. It was clear at a young age she was unusual. As a child, she was an introvert who preferred getting lost in her drawings to playing with friends. She later told authorities she began thinking of murder at a young age, perhaps as young as 3 or 4.
What?
Yeah, that's not normal. That's not a good sign.
No, that's absolutely not.
Like so many children, Shanae had imaginary friends, but hers were maybe a little different than most children. The name of her first imaginary friend was Azazel. Do you know where the name Azazel comes from?
I do not.
In many religions, Azazel is the name given to a goat-like demon and a symbol of Satan.
Okay.
Perhaps as a small child, she overheard her grandfather, who was a reverend for a faith mission church, mention the demon's name. Shanae claimed that Azazel would take over her when she was angry.
Uh-oh.
I think that's a very convenient excuse to justify her bad behavior. Oh, I'm sorry, I was possessed.
It was Azazel.
Right?
It wasn't me.
It was the demon inside me. Eventually, Azazel went away, and Shanae developed a new friend she called Norman. Even as an adult, she would talk and confide to Norman. Shanae's grandma was convinced she was possessed. And at the age of 8, Shanae was brought in front of her grandfather's congregation. He held his hands above her head and implored God to redeem her and release the demons. That's probably going to have an effect on a small child. Yes. I don't know. I'm guessing. Her parents were later described as being completely normal, loving parents. So I'm not sure what happened with the grandparents, but eventually her mom and dad divorced. And her mother remarried a military man shortly thereafter. He would often take Shanae out hunting with him, and he taught her how to skin animals.
Ugh.
This skinning of animals gave her a rush, an excitement she'd never experienced before. She became an expert at it. Like, she was like, pick me, I want to skin that animal.
Really?
And later practiced her skills on animal carcass that she found laying around.
Laying around? Like roadkill?
Yeah, roadkill. I don't know, in the woods, things like that, I'm assuming.
It's fucking weird.
Yeah, it is. It's very odd. At the age of 10, Shanae's dark behavior became unmanageable for her mom. She was put on antidepressants and then sent to live with her father and his new wife, Tanya. Not you.
No.
Another Tanya. Before Shanae's 11th birthday, after getting angry at Tanya, the little girl grabbed a kitchen knife and tried to stab her stepmother. There were no repercussions for this, and it wasn't ever discussed again in the family. They kind of just
brushed it off.
Oh, she got mad. Must have been a Azazel.
Yeah.
I don't know. At the age of 11, Shanae was sniffing benzene and taking ecstasy. At the age of 12, she was raped while at a friend's house at a party by an older boy. Shanae's emotional instability was chalked up to puberty, and her parents believed she was really just a rebellious teen going really? Through a phase. They didn't know all the dark thoughts she had, and they didn't know about her lust for skinning.
Okay.
She was smart enough to keep that stuff inside her. She was an intelligent person. Her IQ was actually 112. And she had the insight to recognize that the fantasies in her mind were not considered norms in society. When she was 15, she started dating a 22-year-old Satanist named Orlando Warren. That had been a disappointment to her parents. And she started dyeing her naturally blonde hair black. Although she was dating a Satanist, Shanae never participated in any Satanist rituals or followed its practices. She was more into the occult and paganism. She found that to be intriguing. And around the age of 18, Shanae appeared to be getting her life on track. She broke up with her Satanist boyfriend, which is a move in the right direction. She got a job working as a graphic artist because she loved drawing and designing. She worked hard and earned enough to get her own flat and buy a car. In addition, her attitude towards her family had changed. She was now respectful, loving, and generous to them. For example, only a few months prior to Michael's murder, Shanae wrote her father, who was going on vacation. She texted him, quote, "You must enjoy your trip, Papa. Remember to take lots of photos. I love you very much. See you when you get back. Love you." So on the outside, she is presenting herself as just this nice, normal young woman. But this was just a facade she presented to the world. Inside her head, she was fantasizing about skinning and cutting people and then sewing them back together.
What?
She was fascinated by dark art, serial killers, and the occult. You know, and I can't judge her for serial
killers.
No,
I can't judge her for that.
I'm not judging her. Again, she was smart enough to keep the fantasies of murder and mutilation a secret. She didn't share it with anybody.
That was probably smart.
That is until she met Martins Vandermartha. The two met through a mutual friend in 2010. Martins was 23 years old. He came from a very respected family in Velcom. His mom was an elementary school teacher. He had just a normal childhood. At the age of 14, he developed audio and visual hallucinations and was diagnosed with schizophrenia. His father devoted most of his time and money to getting Martins the proper medication and treatment. However, as you know, there is no cure for schizophrenia. You can only manage the symptoms. Eventually, Martin's symptoms were very well managed and he could function in society. However, the side effects caused him to gain a lot of weight, which made him self-conscious. He was described as a likable guy, a hard worker. He was a carpenter. He attended college classes. There was nothing in his background that would hint at the violence he was capable of. When these two young people met, the perfect murderous storm was created. Text messages show their relationship was normal for the first few months, and I read through them all. They're just very dry, hey, let's go to the movies kind of thing. But by December, which is maybe 3 months into dating, something changed, and they must have felt comfortable enough with each other to open up about their dark fantasies. Martins was fascinated by death. What happens after you die? He read New Age books. He attended Bible study, and he studied Buddhism, like all these different religions. And of course, Shanae was fascinated with skinning.
She's still on that.
Oh, she is still on that. Yeah, she's still on it. You just wait. This is a 10 on the gruesome scale. By December, Martins was listed in Shanae's contacts as my dark prince.
Oh, how romantic.
And the two began developing their occultish fantasy world. In one text, Martins wrote, quote, "Strength be with you, my goddess. I'm designing how our winter palace will look like in our world. Think of a name for our place if you can. I love you, Lady Bathory Blackmore, XX, Lord Asher, the God Wolf," end quote.
So fucking stupid. I mean, you can cut that out, Joe, but I'm like embarrassed.
No, you can leave that in, Joe. Our editor can leave that in.
I'm so fucking embarrassed by this.
And this part is so cliche. The couple binge-watched the serial killer show Dexter, and Shanae changed Martine's contact info from My Dark Prince to Dexter. And she began calling him Dexter.
Seriously?
Their love life consisted of knife play in which Shanae made deep cuts in Martine's chest. The thought of skinning him sexually aroused her, but she didn't want to hurt him. Not too bad. Martine's, an admitted masochist, allowed Shanae to carve a very large eyeball in his chest. They both self-mutilated and would take turns burning themselves and each other with candles. The two spent their spare time at the cemetery creating their own occult rituals. They weren't into any real occult. They just liked ghoulish things and kind of just made up their own shit along the way. And Martins continued to attend and be very proactive at his Bible study, which he'd been going to for years. It was in March of 2011, after only a few months together, that the young couple moved into a flat together. And that's when they decided it was time to bring their fantasies to life. For the next 2 minutes, probably, I'm going to talk about animal abuse. So if you want to fast forward, maybe a minute or two, if you can't handle it.
Yeesh.
Martins and Shanae went to a pet shop and they purchased two kittens.
Oh, man.
This is going to piss you off.
I don't want to hear this. I can't fast forward.
You cannot fast forward. You cannot leave the room. Someone needs to hear this.
Besides you.
Besides me. And I need to release this. I need to share.
God, I hate people.
They brought the kittens to the cemetery and they recorded themselves mutilating and murdering them. In a video later found by police, Martins can be seen repeatedly stabbing one of the kittens in a fury. Then Shanae decapitates it.
Oh my God.
One kitten was nailed to a cross they made. And Shanae, wearing a small white dress, in the video, she dropped to her knees and she prays in front of the crucified kitten. Later, the video depicts Shanae skinning the animals and they eventually buried the kittens in their backyard.
God damn it.
That is fucked up. Killing the kittens gave them a thrill and brought them closer to each other. They felt like it strengthened their bond. Soon after, they decided to progress to larger animals. Martins came up with a plan to adopt a dog from SPCA.
Get out of here.
No, this is completely true.
This is fucked up.
But while they were on their way there, Shanae decided, and she's later quoted saying, "It would be too cruel to take home an animal that had been abused its entire life and thinks it's going to get a good home only to be killed," end quote. For some reason, she felt compassion, which is odd considering she just slaughtered two kittens. And they decided to forego adopting a dog. Instead, they just moved right on to fulfilling their fantasies with a human being.
They went from two kittens to people.
And that is the evil.
Damn.
That just walked into the Velcom police station. After being greeted by detectives, Shanae introduced Martins as her fiancé and immediately announced she knew the real reason they were there.
Oh.
She wasn't as dumb as we thought.
Right.
They asked her if she knew Michael. Shanae didn't give a solid yes or no, but simply suggested the officers follow her to the flat she shared with Martins on Unicor Street in St. Helena's. An ominous feeling filled the air. But before I tell you more, we're going to take a quick break. Three detectives followed Shanae and Martins to their semi-detached garden flat located on the grounds of this larger home, which I understand is common in South Africa to have like a large house with a smaller flat attached, according to Lindsay, one of our patrons.
Hey, Lindsay.
Hi, Lindsay. Martins was quiet and had a very nonchalant attitude about the whole thing. Shanae agreed to see the officers inside while Martins waited outside with one of the detectives. How the couple could be so calm knowing what awaited these officers inside the home is beyond me. In the living room, there was a beige couch. Cigarettes filled the ashtrays on the coffee table and on the end tables, and the entire apartment smelled like stale cigarettes.
Ugh.
Two tumblers with black flowers immediately caught the detective's eyes. They matched two tumblers found at the crime scene. At the cemetery, officers had found a blanket laid out, two clear tumblers with black flowers, and a candle, which is one of the reasons they believed that Thabo and the one-legged man had nothing to do with it.
Because this weird-ass little scene they found.
Yeah, something kind of romantic, yet not. Shanae and Martins had a shelf, and on that shelf were books. There were some Stephen King books, which I have lots of, by the way. There were books on serial killers. Also have lots of. On the walls were these macabre self-portraits drawn by Shanae. These pictures depicted her with rotting teeth and missing eyes. They were very dark photos. The couple also had a goat skull hung on one of their walls. Some nice decor.
So fucking edgy.
Shanae led detectives Nell and Stein to the kitchen. A magnet held a piece of paper on the small white fridge, which was written in this very beautiful handwriting, like an artist's handwriting. Clearly, it was Shanae. It said, quote, "Angels with needles poke through our eyes and let the ugly light of the world in, and we are no longer blind," end quote. So profound. It happens to be a lyric from the Marilyn Manson song, A Place in the Dirt. Shanae casually strolled to the fridge and opened the top of the fridge's freezer door. She reached in for something that was in between a bag of frozen sweet corn and peas. She placed the clear bag on the counter, taking its contents out for the detectives to examine. The officers didn't know what they were looking at. To them, it looked like raw frozen pizza dough in a ball. "His face," Shanae said, almost proudly to the officers.
No.
What they were staring at wasn't a mushed up pile of dough, but the macabre death mask of Michael Van Eck's face. His eyes were missing. Only skin, once around the sockets, remained, hidden underneath his dark eyebrows. And his eyelids were gone. His pale skin had a faint hue of stubble, but his nose remained as it once was. Shanae had skinned Michael's head and placed it in a plastic bag in the freezer.
I can't even wrap my brain around this.
The scene was more wretched than anything you could read in the Stephen King novel. Michael's mouth had been cut about the corners and then sewn shut. A cut from the right corner of his mouth and another from the left, not more than 3 to 4 centimeters, were now stitched shut. Crudely, his entire mouth had been threaded shut, like the imperfect stitching done to repair a tattered rag doll.
Like loop stitches, probably, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Then Shanae exclaimed, "His eyes," as she reached for a small plastic container from the fridge. Michael's eyeballs were floating around salt water inside a plastic container that she placed on the counter. Reaching once again into the fridge to remove something, Shanae turned to the detectives and said, "His ears." They too were floating around in a plastic container filled with salt water. On top of the fridge was a jar, and it was labeled in very artistic writing, quote, "The spawn of our prostitution," end quote. And there were flames drawn around the wording. The jar contained some of Michael's money from his wallet. Shanae and Martins had robbed Michael. That wasn't the point of his murder. It was just an afterthought, a bonus. Martins was now inside the apartment. He chimed in that not all of Michael's money was there. They had spent some on spades and shovels to help bury their next victim. And he said, quote, "It's not easy to dig a hole with a soup spoon, you know." I'll later describe exactly how Michael was killed, and you'll understand where the soup spoon comes into play. In one of the cupboards, investigators found Michael's glasses and wallet next to a burnt voodoo doll on a Ouija board. On another shelf was what was described in the book I used as a source. The book was called Grave Murder by Jana Vandermarta. On that shelf was a rectangular plastic ice cream container. Removal of the lid revealed the flayed skull of a cat floating in a soapy substance. It was like soap and water. Candle holders in the shape of a skull decorated the couple's bedroom nightstands. And on one of the nightstands was this notebook. It's just a spiral notebook. Inside the notebook, in very feminine, artsy handwriting, was a news article about Michael that had been printed the previous day. It's only like 2 or 3 days after his murder. The article had been folded, so it only showed Michael's photo. And handwritten on the notebook was the entire news article verbatim. Shanae had rewritten it just for some sort of pleasure. And below that were the words Michael, male, 24, welcome. As if that was the first entry in what would be a long list of victims. Investigators found a backpack on the living room floor that had skull prints. I like skulls too, so I can't judge her. I keep my Halloween decorations up all year round. In that backpack, they found a white small sundress. It was covered with blood smears and spatter. Shanae's father and stepmom were called to the flat while Shanae was being arrested. When he got there, he asked her, "Did you do what they say you did?" And she nodded, "Yes." He said, "Why did you do it? Why did you do it?" She responded, quote, "It was something I've wanted to do since I was 3 years old. I wanted to do it. I did it. And I would do it again."
Wow.
End quote. He just stood there stunned. He's like, "Take her away." Martins and Shanae fully cooperated with authorities. They indicated that Michael's remaining body parts could be found buried in their backyard. And they ended up finding Michael's head, arm, and foot next to two dead cat carcasses. His fourth and fifth vertebrae were never located. As they were being transported in a patrol car to jail, Shanae and Martins held hands in the back seat. Isn't that fucking cute?
Yeah, very cute.
They were processed, and investigators found all these cuts, as I had told you before, and burns on their body. The next morning, when guards went to check on Shanae, they found her sitting calmly on her bed because she was in a cell alone, just waiting patiently for them. Blood was everywhere. During the night, Shanae managed to take apart a tin mug used to drink out of, and she deeply sliced both of her upper thighs. Then she took some of her blood and she wrote on the cell prison wall, quote, "Along came a girl," end quote.
Wow.
She's so artsy.
I know. Like, what the fuck is that?
What is that supposed to mean? I don't know. She needs to get over herself. Martins and Shanae spoke openly and freely about how they went about slaughtering Michael. Shanae felt empathy for that dog, but not for her fellow man. For about 2 months, they were cruising the streets looking for a victim. But it wasn't as easy as they thought it would be. So instead, Shanae created that profile on the To Go app. She flirted with Michael and then suggested they meet up at the cemetery, as you know. The cemetery was chosen for its seclusion and also because the couple believed that if they killed their victim in the graveyard, it would ensure that the person's soul would go to Ashmore, the spirit world they had created for their afterlives.
Oh, fuck you.
I don't even know how that works. I just can create my own afterlife spiritual world and people will go to it. Whatever.
Okay. So stupid.
On the day of the murder, Martins worked while Shanae gathered the items they would need for their date night. That included the candles, tumblers, a blanket. She brought some wine and some beer and some knives. When Martins got back from work, the couple had coffee with their landlord. And then they took off on foot to walk the 15 kilometers to the Velcom Cemetery.
Well, that's a long walk.
I know. I thought about that too, but I mean, that was part of their plan. Shanae texted Michael, letting him know how excited she was to see him. While the couple was at the cemetery, they had sex. They were getting themselves all aroused, just thinking about killing Michael. Michael texted Shanae saying he was leaving his home and he should be there shortly. He put in a Eurythmics CD and he drove to the entrance of the Velcom Cemetery. Now, we know that part of him was hesitant, but perhaps part of him was intrigued. Whatever worries he may have had on his way to the cemetery, they were most likely alleviated when he saw this petite young woman standing near a Jewish chapel in a white sundress with just some long flowing hair. Shanae admitted to authorities she was really nervous. She wasn't nervous about the murder, but she was nervous about making small talk with Michael. That sort of stuff made her really uncomfortable. She was an introvert. But she knew she had to play a role She had to keep this ruse up so he wouldn't go away. She ran over to the window of his car, smiling. Michael, disarmed, parked his car and got out. Shanae grabbed his hand and led him to the blanket she'd placed out by the Jewish chapel. She showed him the bottle of wine and two tumblers and the lit candles. It would have been a very romantic first date had it not been in a graveyard. Michael led the conversation, which was a big relief to Shanae. He had no idea that Martins was waiting in the shadows for his cue to attack. Shanae didn't want to keep the charade up for very long, not any longer than necessary. So within a few minutes, she leaned in to give Michael a kiss, which was an indication to Martins that it was time to attack. Martins made a noise in the tree line just behind Michael, and Michael jumped up, yelling, "What the fuck was that?" And that's when Martins plunged a hunting knife into Michael over and over again. Michael took off running towards his car, but Martins managed to slash his legs, causing him to tumble. The palm of Michael's hands were deeply cut as he was trying to fend off the blows. Not willing to die without a fight, Michael wrestled with Martins. And during that wrestling, that's when the corners of Michael's lips were sliced. Michael had a black belt.
Wow.
So he was a very tough, strong man. And it was clear to Martins that Michael was stronger than him. And he wasn't going down. So he yelled out to Shanae to grab a knife from the backpack and help him out. She reached in the backpack and she had the skinning knife that she was intending on using. And she plunged that three times into Michael's back, which began weakening him. Martins then headbutted Michael and made a cut down Michael's cheek from his left eye to his lips. So Michael's face was just being destroyed. Martins continued cutting and slashing Michael, and the agony just grew too much for Michael. He lost his will to live. He cried out, quote, "Oh God, please, please just kill me." Instantly, Martins' slashing frenzy came to a stop, and he asked Michael if he would like to pray first before he received the final death blow. I'm not sure what Michael's response was, but I do know in the end, Martins slit Michael's throat. Then they dragged Michael's body to a more secluded area behind the Jewish chapel, and Shanae went about decapitating his head right then and there at the cemetery. She found it to be much more exerting and exhausting than it had been with the kittens.
Oh, come on. Really? You think it would be easy?
I don't know what she thought. You think that she would know, being Seriously. That she's a professional skinner or whatever they're called. Exhausted, Martins took over for her and was able to complete the decapitation. However, the couple hadn't thought this all through, and they'd only brought with them spoons. And I think that was for some of the snacks she had brought with them in the backpack too. So they had to use spoons to dig a shallow hole to bury Michael in. When they went to bury Michael in the hole, they discovered that he was too big for it. And that's when Martins was tasked with disarticulating Michael's body at the knees. Michael's right arm and left foot were only cut off because Shanae decided she wanted to bring them home along with his head. The couple took Michael's body parts and they put it into the trunk of Michael's car. The reality of what they had just did hit Martins, and he couldn't stop shaking to the point that Shanae, who didn't drive, had to drive home. She put on the song, "Sweet Dreams Are Made of These," and drove back to their place. They brought Michael's body parts inside the house, and then they drove to the taxi stand, and they ditched his car. They trekked all the way home and ended up just being dead tired by the morning. When they got to their place, Martins grabbed Shanae's hands, and he asked her to marry him.
Are you kidding me?
She said yes.
You know what I was thinking, too? They drop his car off. I mean, she's full of blood. They're both full of blood. Like, nobody saw them?
It was nighttime. I guess not.
Huh.
That's a good point. I guess not. After sleeping for a few hours, the couple woke up, and Martins filmed Shanae skinning Michael's head. It took over an hour. She was humming a song while she was doing it. She clearly enjoyed every bit of it. And the skinning was described as being precise. Like she did, this sounds really bad, but she did a really amazing job. This was horrible to say, but then they buried his bones in the garden next to the dead kittens. Both Martins and Shanae agreed that they didn't get the thrill they expected after killing Michael. It wasn't anything like Shanae had read in those books about serial killers, that rush, that high. It was really disappointing to them, and they had decided they were going to do it again to see if they could get a bigger thrill. But then they got caught.
Well, they didn't really get caught. She just like was like, hey, come to my place. I don't understand why they did that.
I don't think anybody really knows. They were just always open and honest about everything that they did.
Like, I was like, okay, if you want to do it again, why are you just leading the police? Oh, and here's his eyes. And I
don't know either.
Weird.
So I told you about the crime. I'm going to tell you quickly about the consequences.
Is this going to piss me off?
No, okay. I don't think so.
Okay.
Maybe a little. I mean, a little bit. Shanae pled guilty to Michael's murder. I mean, what was she going to do? I'm not guilty.
Right.
Come on. She said she didn't realize the amount of grief it would cause her parents and others.
Really?
Although she did admit she would do it again if given the chance. Shanae stared with a blank face as the judge read her sentence. And this is what the judge said. The accused, Shanae Van Heerden, is to be declared a dangerous criminal sentenced to an indefinite prison sentence. She is to follow a range of rehabilitation programs. I don't feel like that's going to help.
No.
After a term of 20 years, she is to reappear before this very court to reevaluate her sentence. If it is found that she still possesses a risk to society, she will be resentenced.
20 years.
The judge says that he gave her 20 years and he did it this way because if he gave her what is considered life in South Africa, she can be paroled. She will be paroled after 25 years.
Oh, okay.
So this way, if he's still around and she comes before him, he can say, oh, I don't feel like you're rehabilitated, and he can send her back. Martine's court hearing was delayed for mental health evaluations. I mean, he had schizophrenia and he had quit taking his medicine prior to the murders. However, the court determined that his schizophrenia played no part in the crime itself. Martins acknowledged his actions and he appeared genuinely remorseful. Unlike his counterpart, Martins apologized over and over and over again. Shanae never did. As to why he did it, he said, quote, I thought in seeing him die, in observing something in his eyes, I'd understand. I was hoping Shanae would be happy with me if she had Van Eck to cut up, end quote. Martins was given a life sentence, which means that he will be probably out by the time he's 51 years old after 25 years in prison. So where are they now?
Where are they now?
Well, Shanae had a pen pal relationship going with that guy who sells serial killer memorabilia.
Ugh.
And she gave him some stuff to sell. She is serving a life sentence at a female correctional center. She's studying courses in theology and teaching art to her fellow inmates. And she has been described as a model prisoner. Martins is serving his sentence in a maximum security prison in the Free State. He's gotten some sort of certificate and he's continuing his education. Tanya, the couple broke up.
No.
2014, they broke up with each other. But before that, they were writing love letters. When questioned about the breakup, Shanae said that they had both changed.
You don't say.
They've grown apart. So that is the story of, just an awful story of what happened to Michael Van Eck. I feel so much compassion for his family. And I fear if Shanae ever gets released, what would happen to somebody else. I want to once again thank the author, Jana Van Der Martha, for the book Grave Murder. And I also want to thank True Crime South Africa. I listened to that podcast too to get the information on it, along with some other articles. That's it. That's the story.
Jesus.
That's a lot.
That's awful.
It's horrible.
What the fuck is the matter with people?
I don't know.
I don't know either. And that's why we continue to do this.
You guys should go to our website, crimesandconsequences.com, to look at the photos. You would not believe the photos. And you can see why Michael would be disarmed by Shanae. She's just this little, cute, teeny bopper kind of looking thing. I want to ask you guys one more time, if you haven't done so already, to hit the subscribe / follow button. Again, I want to give a shout out to Clevenol P for the recommendation, and Lindsay for helping me pronounce some of these names, though I'm sure I still slaughtered it. Check us out on our Instagram at Hardcore True Crime or our Facebook at Hardcore True Crime. You can also become a Patreon member and get ad-free early releases plus 100 exclusive episodes. All that can also be gotten from our Apple channel on Apple Podcast. And don't forget to check out our merch at crimesandconsequences.com. Did I get it all?
I think so.
I want to give a special round of applause for Tanya for putting up with us.
Man. Yeah. Thanks, Talia.
With a bad back.
Yes. I'm in a little bit of pain, but I'll live.
It all seems very tiny right now, doesn't it? Tiny little bit of pain.
Yeah, just a little pain. It's all
no biggie. It's all relative.
Until our next episode.
Don't kill each other.
Bye.
Bye.